We're continuing our study of the 17th Psalm. In our last lesson, we'd gotten through the 7th verse. So we'll be beginning this time with the 8th verse of the 17th Psalm. This psalm is a prayer. It is a fervent, earnest, believing prayer. We believe that it was written by David. So it's a prayer of David. And it was given in view of danger. Danger that was arising from the number and purposes of his enemies that were against him. We do not know exactly what the occasion was that David wrote this psalm. There were many occasions in the life of David that such a prayer would have been most appropriate. And there can be no doubt that in the dangers that so frequently beset him, that he often gave out such warm and earnest appeals to God for help. There can also be no doubt that we today can use the very same expressions, the same feelings in our prayers to God, because we have the same needs that the writer of this psalm had. We have enemies that are very similar to his enemies. We have enemies with the same designs that they had, that have the same character that they had. And so this is a most appropriate psalm for us today also. His enemies were deadly, bitter foes. They were prosperous in the world. They were proud, and they were fierce and greedy like a lion hunting its prey. We today, as we encounter enemies of a similar nature, find that we also have enemies that are very dangerous. They're fierce, because anything that can cause us to lose our soul is something that is most deadly to us. And the enemies that we have today can do that. They can turn us away from God. They can cause us to leave the church. They can cause us to stray away from the narrow paths of God. And when that happens, then we've had a most deadly thing happen to us. As we begin to study this 8th verse, we're in a portion of this psalm in which David is giving a plea for God to help him. And this begins back with about the 5th or 6th verse. He says in the 5th verse, "Hold up my goings and thy paths, that my footsteps slip not. I have called upon thee, for thou wilt hear me, O God. Incline thine ear unto me, and hear my speech. Show thy marvelous loving kindness, O thou that savest by thy right hand them which put their trust in thee from those that rise up against them." Now we commented on these verses in the last lesson. So now as we move into the 8th verse, we notice that it says, "Keep me as the apple of the eye, hide me under the shadow of thy wings." Now this is a very beautiful verse, but it comes from a most difficult grammatical construction. And we do not want to get into all of the difficulties of this, but the literal translation of this verse would be rendered like this: "Keep me as the little man, the daughter of the eye." And of course that doesn't make a whole lot of reasoning or sense to us. In Zechariah 2 and 8, the word that's translated there for apple of the eye really means the pupil of the eye. And it seems that what he's really saying here is, to keep me like you would keep the eye, to regard me as something as precious to you as your eye is. And of course it's very easy for us to see then what a precious thing that would be. When you're guarding someone like you're guarding your eye, then this is a precious object you're guarding. And so that's what the prayer of the psalmist is here to God, is to look upon me as something as precious as someone would regard the eye being, and keep me like that. Keep me as the apple of the eye. He further says, "Hide me under the shadow of thy wings." Another very beautiful figure of a fowl, like a mother hen that would protect her young. As the young then have some danger, they run to the mother hen and she lets them come under her wings for relief or protection from the danger, and also for protection from the elements. They can get under her wings for warmth in the cold winter time. They can also get under her wings for shade in the hot sun. So we see that this 8th verse then is simply a plea to God to give a high regard to the one who's giving this psalm. "Keep me as the apple of thine eye, and to hide me under the shadow of thy wings." Now this is a statement that's very similar to one that's made in Deuteronomy chapter 32. And I'd like to read that statement over in Deuteronomy, because it may very well be that the psalmist was simply quoting from this statement in Deuteronomy. So in Deuteronomy 32, beginning with the 10th verse, "He found him in a desert land, and in the waste howling wilderness. He led him about, He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, beareth them on her wings. So the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. So we see simply what is being said here is that loving, tender care was being given to God's people by God. And so that psalmist asked for this to be given also at this time. Look upon me now like you have looked upon your people in the times past. When you brought them through the great wilderness crisis, when you brought them into this land originally, and you were their God, you instructed them, you led them, you guided them, you guarded them in every kind of way. Look upon me in that very same capacity. And so it's a very beautiful little verse, but it's simply a part of David's plea to God to help him, to guard him, and to protect him. And oh, how often do we today have the need to express this very same kind of sentiment to God. We have a need for this same God to protect us, to guide us, to guard us. We have a need for Him to be close to us, to help us in times of need, in times of trouble, in times of distress. So this is a most appropriate thought for us to also express to our God today, because in this area our needs are as great as David's were, and our God is the same God that his God was. And this is something given to him by miraculous inspiration to be used in his relationship to God. In verse 9, the thought that was begun in verse 8 is completed. It's the completion of the sentence. In verse 8, he's asking God to keep him, to hide him. And then in verse 9, he says, from the wicked that oppress me, from my deadly enemies who compass me about. So verse 9 gives a description of the ones that David is asking God to protect him from. He says, from the wicked that oppress me. And this word oppress really can be translated as waste. They're wasting me. That is, they're destroying me. They're causing me to use my energies, my time, my resources, and trying to simply survive their onslaught against me. He further says, from my deadly enemies. And this phrase, deadly enemies, can really mean the enemies that are against my soul. These are the enemies that are going to cause me to lose my soul. They're against my spiritual man. Not only are they going to do me physical damage, but they can also do me spiritual harm. And we know that we have many enemies like this. They're enemies that are against the soul. They're enemies that are against our physical as well as our spiritual selves. They'd like to see us in some way fall away from our present faith. They'd like to bring about a change in us so that we no longer are serving God. We no longer are following after him in the ways that he would have us to do, and then this would somehow or other bring about a victory for them. There are many who feel a sense of being uncomfortable in the presence of those who are serving God. And so if they can get them to change, then this somehow or other gives them a little soothing of their conscience to know that you too are not doing any better toward God than they are. And so they're enemies against the soul. In that sense, they are truly deadly enemies, because they're going to be the type of an enemy that's going to make you to lose your soul and make you have to then spend eternity in a condition separated from God. So these are wicked enemies. They're deadly enemies. They're enemies against the soul. And he says, who compass me about. That is, they are surrounding me. They're everywhere. And I want you to keep me then, like you would keep something as precious as the eye. That you would hide me under the shadow of your wings from these deadly enemies that compass me about. Beginning in verse 10 and extending through verse 14, we have a description of the character of these wicked enemies. These are the enemies that were opposing David, the ones that prompted him to give this plea to God to help him. And as we see what their character and nature was then, we'll find that the enemies that we have today have a very similar character and nature today. Verse 10 says, they are enclosed in their own fat. With their mouth they speak proudly. Now, to be enclosed in their own fat is a way of saying that they're prosperous. They're very prosperous. And as you observe the people who are in the world, the people who are so ungodly, they appear to be, on the surface, so very prosperous. And in material things, they are prosperous. They may have the very best in the way of houses and clothing and a car and a job and so forth. But this doesn't tell us anything about the prosperity of their soul. Spiritually wise, they are very poverty-stricken. But because of this financial and physical prosperity that they have, they seem to have a lot of power. They seem to have a lot of ability to overcome those that are righteous. But really, they cannot do anything against God. So they're enclosed in their own fat. They're prosperous. With their mouth, they speak proudly, or they speak very arrogant things. And this last phrase of verse 10 is simply a result of their prosperity. Because they are so prosperous, because they have a lot of financial clout, then they can speak very arrogantly. They can behave in a very haughty, proud manner. And this then makes them appear to be ever more fierce. This gives them an appearance of having a lot of strength, a lot of ability to carry out their threats against us. But here again, we must remember that they can do nothing against God. But this is the character, this is the nature that the enemies are going to have. They're going to be prosperous, and they're going to go about with an arrogant, proud manner, and it'll be reflected in their speech. They'll brag, they'll boast, they will threaten, and they will appear to be ever so powerful. Verse 11, they have now compassed us in our steps. They have set their eyes bowing down to the earth. Here the picture is that these arrogant, haughty, prosperous enemies had now surrounded David. And he uses the word us and our, which indicates that it's not just David alone, but it's those that are his companions. There are a group now that are associated together that are having this persecution in common. They have compassed us in our steps, so that those that would help David are now partakers of the tribulation that he has. To have compassed us in our steps means that we are surrounded. If we take another step, we're going to go in more into danger. They have set their eyes, bowing down to the earth. To set their eyes means that they're looking intently at us, or toward us, or for us. Bowing down to the earth, as though they have crouched down close to the earth, ready to spring upon us, ready to draw a bead upon us with their weapon. Ready to take careful aim so that they do not miss when they do attack us. Verse 12, like as a lion that is greedy of his prey. Here's a lion that's ready to spring upon his prey. He has the prey all surrounded, and he's ready now to spring upon him. He's greedy of his prey. He has a very emotional feeling about this prey because it's his food, it's his meal, it's his life. And he must have the prey to be able to live himself, so he's going to use every effort that he can to get this prey. He's greedy of his prey. And of course, any of us who've seen animals, say like even a dog that is eating, we know that at the time they're eating food, they are emotional about that food. That's the time you don't want to start bothering the dog, because if he's ever going to bite you, he's going to bite you when he's in that food situation, because he's greedy of his prey. And this is the way these enemies were attacking the writer of this psalm. And he further says in verse 12, and as it were a young lion lurking in secret places. Just another way of saying what he's already said about the lion, but now he describes the lion as a young lion, which means it's a very vigorous lion. It's not sick, it's not old or feeble, but it's very vigorous. It's able to have the utmost in its strength and agility, and so it would be the most dangerous kind of an animal then to have dealings with. A young lion lurking in secret places. Here this enemy is not necessarily out in the open and can be seen easily, but it's a lurking enemy. It's an enemy that can spring at the most unopportune time for you. It's an enemy that will wait till you're at your weakest. It'll wait till you're most vulnerable, and then it will spring upon you and have success in destroying you. So verse 13, he says, arise, O Lord, disappoint him, cast him down, deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword. Here he's simply calling upon the Lord to give him protection from these enemies. Arise, O Lord. Give the sense that the Lord maybe has been reclining. It's a figurative term. And the Lord has not been paying as much attention now, or being as active in, on his behalf as he would like or need for him to be. So he calls upon the Lord to arise and disappoint him. That is, do not let the enemy achieve that which he wants to achieve in my respect, in my regard. Do not let him consume me. Do not let him destroy me as he is trying to do. Disappoint him. Do not let him be successful in this endeavor against me. Cast him down. That is, absolutely defeat him. Destroy his actions against me. He says, further, deliver my soul from the wicked. Now, deliver my soul from the wicked simply means to give me salvation, to somehow or other work matters so that I am freed from him, I'm saved from him, I am not in his grasp, for I am not destroyed by him. Deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword. Now this is a little difficult phrase here to apply, as it's written in the King James Version, which is thy sword, would imply then that the wicked was the sword of God. Now we know that this is a true principle, of course. God does use the wicked as his weapons or tools here upon this earth to carry out his will. He uses the wicked nations to do the things that he needs to have done among nations. He uses wicked men in this respect. And some say that this has a different reference then to Saul, that Saul was the enemy that David had reference to, and Saul was his sword at this time. Saul was his king, the king of Israel, the king of a nation. And this may very well be the meaning. However, it seems that most of the translators give a different meaning to this. Instead of saying, which is thy sword, referring to the wicked, they simply say, to destroy the wicked with or by thy sword. Use your sword to destroy the wicked with. And we can also see how that would be a most applicable phrase to the way that God works, because God does use his sword, he does use his power, his ability, his weapons, to destroy the wicked and to bring us then into a state of peace and salvation from the onslaught of the wicked. He further says in verse 14, continuing that thought, from the men which are thy hand. And this here again is translated from men by thy hand, or by thy weapon, by thy ability. And he's asking God to save him from these men, from these wicked men. O Lord, from men of the world. Now these are men that are of the world. They do not come from God. They're not spiritually inclined. They're not spiritually motivated. They are not aware of the higher things of God, but they are from the baser elements of life. They are simply from the world. They are the natural man. They are not the spiritual man. And so all of their thoughts and motives, their philosophies, are going to be based upon things that come simply from the world and not things that are from above. This is why we have to be so careful about teaching that comes from man, because the mind of man is not the mind of God, and the teaching that man will give in his philosophy is not the teaching that God will give. And so then we have to be sure that our teaching comes from above, that it is teaching that is given by God, because from things of the world are not things of God. So these are men which have their portion in this life. That is, all the things that they're looking for, all their desires come from what they get out of this life. They're not building anything for the future. They don't have any treasure laid up in heaven, and they're not going to have a successful time of it at the judgment. They're not going to be given that life after this life like the children of God are. So their portion's in this life, whose belly thou fillest with thy hid treasure. That is, they simply want to satisfy their materialistic needs now. They are able to satisfy those. Their belly is filled with thy hid treasure. That is, they're able to get all the treasures of earth and fill themselves with it. They're satisfied with these things. That's the object of their whole life. And hid treasure may indicate that these treasures are not easy to obtain. So these people work hard at this. They're very clever. They're very cunning. They're very skilled at what they do. They don't just get these things by accident, but they put a lot of hard work into it. And yet they are able to fill their belly with these hidden treasures of God. He further says they are full of children. That's a very difficult phrase to explain. It's translated several ways, but it probably means that they have a lot of children. They have big families. They have prosperous families. And leave the rest of their substance to their babies. That is, they're able to leave a lot of inheritance to their family, to their offspring. And of course, we see this in the world today. Those that are so affluent and so rich, many times they do leave huge fortunes to their offspring, to their children. They have children many times that never have to work at all because they have such huge fortunes, such great masses of money and treasure that they spend the rest of their life in living off of that, or maybe even wasting and squandering it. But here's a description of the wicked. These are the ones that David is praying to God to give him relief against. They're people of the world. They do not have anything in mind except to heap together worldly treasures. And they're very successful in that. But they're not spiritually inclined. They don't have any portion anywhere except in this life. Nothing to look forward to after this life. And so this is an adequate, apt description of the wicked and of those that would oppress the true followers of God. But in verse 15, he shows the contrast between the wicked and those that are righteous. He begins verse 15 by saying, "As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness." So as for me, I'm different. I do not have my entire trust in this life, in the pleasures of this life, and the treasures of this life. I'm not striving to fill my belly with the things of this life. I'm looking for something else. I'm going to behold thy face in righteousness. And he has a reference here to the resurrection of the dead. There's coming a time when I'm going to see thy face in righteousness. That is, as a result of my righteous life, as a result of following after the righteous things, I'm going to be able to see thy face. And that's what I'm looking forward to more than anything that I would get out of this life. He says, "I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." He's talking about the time when he resurrects from the grave, when he has another life after this one, a life that's going to give him things that cannot be found in this life. He's showing that his portion is not in this life and this life only, but he has something to look forward to in the future. "So I'll be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." That is, I'm going to awaken with thy moral character. I'm going to be like my God. I will be given such a nature and such a character at the time of the resurrection that I'll be like God in the moral, spiritual sense of the term. And so that's what I look for. I do not look for this life to satisfy me. This life is not my portion, and that's what separates me from those wicked who so greatly oppress me. I'm looking forward to being with my God. I'm looking forward to resurrecting from the dead and be like Him, and to see his face, and then I shall be satisfied. So we bring to a close this 17th Psalm. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friend.